Hello and welcome. This is Beyond Reproach.
Yes, it's Stephanie Domingo.
And Tux Lurzel signing on.
Hi guys.
Welcome.
Fancy meeting you here.
Oh, I didn't see you there. So we're here, we're drinking.
Oh, we didn't cheers.
Oh, yeah, well, let's cheers. Cheers.
When I was a kid at school learning the golden rule, teacher often used to say, if you don't tell a lie, there's not a reason why you can't be like Washington someday. How could Washington be a married man and never, never tell a lie?
Heavy glasses. So we're drinking out of these hurricane glasses that are ridiculously frou-frou. Our drinks currently, like, literally have a wedge of pineapple, a maraschino cherry, like, a real, like, grocery store neon red one, not, like, the good Italian ones.
Not the fancy Brooklyn ones.
Yeah, and a cocktail parasol. And the drink itself is, like, Drano blue.
It looks like cotton candy.
Yeah, now. It's cotton candy blue now.
Oh, the color of blue curacao is horrifying. It's deeper than Drano. It's
so
I've never
it's
seen
like
a color.
Blue.
It's cerulean.
Yes. Ooh, look at you with the $5 words.
Oh my god, I laughed so hard my back hurt. Tim, edit that out. I am not that old.
Stephanie's going first today, and her scandal is from the 1980s in America. The age of excess and the age of ridiculous frou-frou fruity cocktails.
There's a lot of time periods, but the 80s is kind of like the classic.
Okay.
It's like when it's at its peak.
Okay.
So...
Well, at this point, you get it. You know that we choose a cocktail that sort of epitomizes the era that, or at least our interpretation of the era. And when Stephanie told me that we had to do an 80s cocktail, at first I was super excited.
Yeah.
And then the moment I started Googling, I got really sad because apparently the things that people cared about in the 80s were sugar, and sugar,
yeah.
And money.
And obviously. Money, and doing ridiculous things with sugar and money.
Yes.
Yeah, the layered cocktail.
Yeah, there were a lot of shots.
Good
I think
God.
Shots started
yeah.
to become a thing in the
yeah.
80s.
Oh. I was thinking that we would just do a whole bunch of cocaine in this episode.
So that's what we should have made artisanal cocaine.
Yes!
Brooklyn.
There's like fig in it. Cocaine? Oh my god. If this podcast doesn't work out.
Oh my god.
Oh, ooh, oh god. Oh man.
No, so it says
what happened?
Detected feedback. It said there
my
was a laugh feedback issue.
Blew out the microphone just then, you guys, but we're back.
That happened. So this cocktail is real fancy. It's a rum-based, blue curacao-based frozen drink. Called the Blue Hawaiian. The blue curacao is ridiculous. The rum is the only thing that redeems it. I was certain it was going to be way too sweet.
Yeah, I was afraid.
Oh, what? No, we were talking about...
We were talking about layered cocktails.
God damn it. Shots were a big thing. Layered cocktails were a big thing. Cocktails that had
sexy
sexual...
names.
Yes,
yeah.
Sexual innuendos or sexy names. Cocktails that contained tropical fruit. Anything that was like pineapple,
yeah.
rum, or pineapple, or coconut, or
so
citrus. Everything had schnapps in it, or some kind of fruity, whatever. Mm. I mean...
My mom would be in heaven.
Yeah. Blue curacao, obviously, is like fruity. It's sort of citrusy.
Yeah. It's orange
It's actually
flavored.
Not from an orange, though. It's from a specific plant. I looked it up, and I have already forgotten. It's from a certain type of plant that has an orangey... flavor, but it's not actually orange.
Wow, I did not know that.
Yeah.
It's surprisingly delicious. I
yes.
think it's my favorite. That
I can't believe you're saying that.
I know. And I'm on the rec. I'm saying this into a microphone.
I mean, if I'm going to have to pick a favorite, this is probably not it.
It feels like summer.
I mean, it's just fun to hold it. The the shape of the glass, the freaking pineapple and cherry and the cocktail parasol.
This just reminds me so much of... pina colada.
Yeah.
But it's, well, like, less sweet, which is, like, perfect.
Well, that's because I cheated because I was very concerned that every option that we had was very sweet.
Yeah.
But I decided to use slightly less pineapple juice than it called for.
Yeah, but only slightly.
Yeah.
It's not, like,
I used,
really...
It called for 3 ounces. I used 2.
Yeah.
And it's delicious.
It's so good.
It's, I really was not expecting to like it. Good. And I'm literally almost finished.
Yeah, I'm almost finished
already.
As well. But yeah, we were going to talk about travel, right?
Yeah, so Stephanie and I have both been traveling.
Tux went on a road trip and I went to Italy for intensive Italian boot camp, which was really, it was really good. I was in this beautiful, beautiful area, the southern part of Sicily called Siracusa, and the weather was perfect. It felt like summer again, but I was in class 5 hours a day, and then I had papers to write and homework every night, so I didn't even go to the beach once, but it was still, I'm still glad that I did it. I ate a lot of really good food, like fresh seafood and all the pastries, because Italian food, like Italian breakfast is dessert.
Yeah.
Like everything has like 3 ounces of Nutella on it, and it's just, it's so sugary sweet and so delicious. So I had fun. I had some indulgences, but it was a super nerdy trip that I would probably do again because it was really good.
That, I mean, that's super impressive that you're really sticking to it.
Well, then I've invested enough time, and yeah. I really enjoy traveling in Italy. It's it's like a mental health break,
yeah,
in a way.
Yeah.
Because I go there and everyone is really friendly, and I mean, the men there are very like, I mean, they catcall you. They do that in New York, but it's, yeah, in Italy, they're not. There's not that like creepy, violent sort of like twinge to being approached by a man.
Yeah.
Like it's always just like praise.
Yeah.
And, like,
yeah,
they're not like, oh fuck you, bitch, if you say like. Every time in New York, literally every time I turn down or I just ignore a man, there is a split second that I'm like, I hope he doesn't shoot me. Like, oh, I hope Jesus. He doesn't shoot me. Like, there was a guy today, I was just walking down the street, he slowed down his car, and I turned, I saw him, and I just kept walking, and he screamed something at me, and I'm just like, just keep walking, there's people around, just keep walking.
Yeah.
But, like, that's always a fear. I never think of that in Italy, because it's just, the vibe is not violent.
Yeah, yeah.
At all.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Oh, to be a woman in America.
Yeah.
Yeah, so speaking of America, I did this road trip.
Yes.
Like, my best friend from high school and I, she's been living in Portland for a long time, and she decided to move back to New York. So I went out, I flew out to Portland, and then we drove back together. And we sort of zigzagged across the country. We spent some time, like, sightseeing and did a little hiking, did a little camping in southern Utah. Which, if you've never been to Utah or southern Utah...
Your pictures are gorgeous.
Yeah. It is just...
Stunning,
it's,
right?
Like, mind-blowingly beautiful. It's incredible. It's incredible. It's... So mind-blowing.
I've never
beautiful.
Been to the Plain States. I need to go. I hear Montana and Wyoming also are really, really beautiful.
Yeah.
But Utah, yeah.
Utah is all these, like, crazy rock formations.
Yeah.
Everything is red.
It looks like a different planet.
It literally feels like you're on Mars. Like, we drove through Monument Valley. We went to Zion. We didn't really stay very long, but we drove through Moab. I mean, it's a big state, but, like, we went to Salt Lake City.
It's a really big state.
She had a friend who lived in Portland who had moved to Salt Lake City, so I spent some time there, too, and wasn't expecting to like Salt Lake, but it was beautiful, too. But it was kind of like where she lived. It's kind of, like, hipstery. She said that people... I can't remember. I think South Salt Lake...
Oh.
Is where the neighborhood where she lives, and she said that, like, when she and her husband bought their house, that people were like, oh, you're moving to, like, the ghetto. And
she's like, oh my god.
Yeah, they live in a beautiful, beautiful home. She took us to breakfast the next morning at some, like, biscuit restaurant that had, like, the most amazing homemade buttermilk biscuits. And
I love biscuits.
Yeah.
I like having the antidote.
Yeah.
Like, to New York.
Yeah.
Like, I don't need to be in a big city. I want to be away from people. I want to kind of disappear.
Yeah. But we made it through. We made it all the way across the U.S. Most of our sightseeing was in southern Utah, northern Arizona. We went to Denver. We saw on tractor trailers the blades for the windmills. Like, one blade would be on the back of a tractor trailer, and the blade itself was longer than a normal tractor trailer, and they had, like, an extended...
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah. They had to have, like, an extended cab on the back to transport
it. Yeah, because we never see
it.
Them up close. Like, I've never seen one up close.
Just the blade.
Wow.
We saw a couple of those
Incredible.
On the highway. Yeah. But anyways, we had a good time. We made it through the middle of the country. Nobody killed us.
You're a success story.
Yes, yeah.
You did it.
Yeah.
Despite all the odds.
But all this talk has made me want another cocktail. So
yeah.
We should do that and then start your tale.
Let's do that, my tale.
Okay.
So as always, I like to start out with a bit of background as to why I picked my political tale. My scandal this episode is personal. Mm. Not just for me, but probably for you as well. It involves something that the majority of us today have experienced firsthand as children.
Oh.
Yes. it is the glue that binds us all. All of us who were in, like, organized school. Homeschool kids, I guess, are probably exempt. Lucky bastards.
I don't know if I would, well.
Homeschooled, if they're lucky. Because they're weird, right? Aren't we all
weird?
Okay, they're weirder than most.
Well, I think it's just like you're not learning certain social skills at a very important time in your life to learn them.
I know some homeschooled people who are completely normal, but they all had a lot of siblings.
Yeah.
Okay. So they had that interaction.
Yeah.
So this is something that happened when I was a child. I definitely knew that it was stupid. Maybe a little racist, but not scandalous. I had no clue. Okay, so my scandal revolves around an anti-Semitic automaker, a racist state senator, a number of backroom state legislative resolutions, and some inexplicable dance-related fascism. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No.
Yes! I don't know! I love it! Okay, so I'm talking about square dancing.
Okay, so like square dancing I know is super racist. Like, it has racist roots, and there was a lot of...
You know, generally.
I have a general idea, but okay. I don't... I love that you're doing this. Okay. Yes.
First off, I'd like to start and say that I love that it's called square dancing. It's
for squares.
It's a little too on the nose. It warms my heart. So if you were raised in the U.S., chances are high that you've learned to square dance at various times in gym class.
Yes.
There's an odd and little known reason why so many students spent their formative years learning to do-si-do. 31 out of 50 states have declared square dancing their official folk dance.
Because every state needs an official folk dance.
Yeah, so if you dig in a little deeper, you find a coordinated but thankfully failed political campaign to make square dancing our official country dance. The folk dance of the United States of America. That's what they were trying to do. So it's not just about the joys of
boots
dancing.
Scootin', trying to bring it back to the 80s.
Yes! At its core, it's part of America's legacy of racism and anti-Semitism and the strange tools that are used to uphold whiteness. The scandal starts with jazz. A black art form that has its roots in New Orleans. Did you know that New Orleans was the only territory that allowed its enslaved people to have drums?
Oh, I didn't know that.
They allowed them to make their drums and to use their drums. So that's where all music basically comes from.
Wow.
So it started as a social dance in the late 1800s, created by enslaved people on southern plantations with roots in tribal folk styles, evolved into something that everyone could dance to. Over a few decades, these folk dances were simplified and standardized. The juba from Congo became the Charleston. Ragtime slowed down, becoming the foxtrot. The shimmy shawabble became the shimmy. Harlem's Lindy Hop and Jitterbug became modern swing. So what does jazz dancing have to do with its painfully square counterpart? Everything. So to understand how square dancing became a state-mandated means of celebrating air quotes Americana, it's necessary to go back to Harry Ford, because he started it all, really. So this is Henry Ford, the founder of Ford Motor Company.
Oh, that's why.
In an article I found in Quartz by Robin Panaccia, she's quoted as saying, Ford, quote, hated jazz, he hated the Charleston, he also really hated Jewish people, and he believed that Jewish people invented jazz as a part of a nefarious plot to corrupt the masses and take over the world, end quote.
What?
Yes, right? I read that and like my jaw dropped to the ground and I was that like emoji with the big eyes. Like, what?
I mean, Jewish people have been blamed for so many things, but I don't think I've ever heard anyone trying to blame Jewish people for jazz.
Oh, I haven't even, you don't even know yet. Jazz is like on the bottom of the list of the things that he blamed Jewish people for.
No.
So I thought reading that, I'm like, I read this article, I'm like, this is hyperbole. It is not hyperbole. So I did a little Googling to find out how did this man get so incredibly anti-Semitic and like incredibly racist. I couldn't find it.
He was born in America?
Yeah, he was born in Michigan. He came out of a vagina in the late 1800s in Dearborn, Michigan. But yeah, his hatred for Jewish people was so well documented, so legendary that I was like embarrassed that I didn't even know.
Yeah.
Did you know any of this?
I didn't. I knew that he was...
Because we learned about Ford in school, but Because, wow.
Yeah, they're not good at teaching the bad stuff.
Ford blamed Jewish people for everything. Everything. He attributed much of the evil of the world to Jewish people and Jewish, quote, capitalists. According to him...
Bitch, you're a capitalist.
Thank you. You are the fucking... That was my first thought. I'm like, really, a bitch?
Yeah,
like,
you really are the king of the fucking capitalists.
Calling the kettle all the black. Like, oh what? God. Yes. So according to him, they could control minds. They caused the war. They cause outbreaks of robberies all over the country. They somehow even cause inefficiencies in the Navy.
Okay.
So in 1918, Ford purchased his hometown paper, the Dearborn Independent. And this is when he really gets next level with his bigotry. A year and a half later, as Hitler is rising to power, so this is the time that he's doing all this shit, he began writing a series of really dangerous and really poorly reasoned, obviously, articles that claimed this vast Jewish conspiracy that was infecting America. This air quote expose ran in 91 of his issues. So for
91
during the rise of fucking Hitler. So he takes these 91 articles that he wrote with his, like, hateful garbage, and he makes an anthology. He puts it in 4 volumes. He calls it The International Jew. And he distributes 500,000 copies to his vast network of dealerships and subscribers. In volume 3, written in 1921, he writes, quote, "Many people have wondered whence come the waves upon waves of musical slush that invade decent homes and set the young people of this generation imitating the drivel of morons. Popular music is a Jewish monopoly. Jazz is a Jewish creation. This mush slush, the sly suggestion, the abandoned sensuousness of sliding notes are of Jewish origin." End quote.
What?
Yeah, exactly. I love that you're having this reaction because I'm like, God, he already knows about him.
No. Yeah. I did not know any of this. Yes. It's just, I feel like obviously black people deserve credit.
Yes.
But also, like,
but we'll
if you're
going to
gonna pass blame, do they deserve blame for jazz music? Because,
I'll get there. So like Hitler, Ford believed that Jewish people were evil geniuses diabolically planning to control the world. Black people, he thought, were not necessarily evil, but not smart enough to resist Jewish mind control.
So they were just tools of the Jewish...
Yes. They made us create jazz just so they could make it popular and ruin America. So there would be stacks of these anthologies, like this 4-volume piece of garbage that he made, in dealerships across the U.S. The dealerships would actually put copies of this newspaper in cars. So you would buy a Model T, and, like, right next to you would be this garbage, this, like, hateful nonsense.
Holy shit.
Dangerous what he did. His hatred was so powerful that the Führer himself gave him a shout-out in Mein Kampf. He's the only American named.
Oh, my God. They don't teach you that one in schools.
Exactly. In 1938, Ford received an award from the Nazi regime called the Grand Cross of the German Eagle. I mean, Hitler, he said that he was impressed with his modernizations of the assembly line, but also his Nazism. Yeah. No, it would be one thing if he was just like some dude being anti-Semitic, but he was Henry Ford.
Yeah.
He had the power of the press, and this was way before they had those copyright laws. Newspapers would just print other newspapers' stories.
Yeah.
So what he wrote was printed all over during the rise of Hitler. To be a history teacher and not teach this is irresponsible, and it's a lie. It's disgusting, really. It's disgusting. I was like, I can't believe this.
And he's glorified
still to this day. So Ford is garbage juice. That's actually in my notes.
Hot New York garbage juice.
But all accounts suggest that he had progressive views when it came to his workforce.
Uh-huh.
He hired black workers and he paid them the same as white workers.
Wow.
In the 20s and 30s. Like, that shit doesn't happen now. And he was doing this in the 20s and the 30s. But yeah, when I read that, I'm like, okay? Like, why? So moral licensing, or sometimes it's called a self-licensing, is defined. It's a term used in social psychology and marketing to describe the subconscious phenomenon whereby increased confidence and security in one's own self-image or self-concept tends to make the individual worry less about the consequences of subsequent immoral behavior, and therefore more likely to make immoral choices and act immorally. I know that's a lot of words, but it basically is when people allow themselves to indulge after being good. It's like diet soda with like a value meal.
Yeah. I think I heard somebody was talking about this.
Studies have shown that people who express a strong disagreement with sexist statements are then more likely to hire a man for a job because they feel secure about not being sexist. Therefore, they pay less attention to their possible biases. And the same thing happens with race. People who feel like they're not racist are more likely to discriminate against racial minorities, which explains white feminism.
It was the podcast that you sent me, the Revisionist History, how that artist, the female artist, came out with that painting and then...
Oh, yes!
Yeah,
yes.
And then so because they let this female painter...
Mm-hmm.
Have this one painting in this gallery, then the art council was like, well, we don't have to have a woman ever, like, in the next 10 years.
And the same is true with the first female politician in Australia. Yeah. It just unleashed the floodgates of sexism.
Yeah, so if you're kind of a racist, but you do one nice thing to
like
a
voting
black
for
person,
Obama, and it's like, now I can use the N-word.
Yeah, exactly. Because I'm not
a racist.
Yeah,
I voted for Obama,
so I'm not a racist, so I can use the N-word freely now.
It's just a word.
Yeah.
That I love.
If you guys care, Revisionist History, it's real good.
So, I'm obsessed with that podcast.
Yeah.
Malcolm Gladwell, he's on the list.
Lin-Manuel.
he's number two. So Ford, even though he has this policy where he's treating his workers equally, he's equally worried about the influence of jazz on these workers. He fears that they'll be morally corrupted by the evil forces of jazz, that they'd be led astray, propelled towards liquor and sex and other really fun adult things.
Yeah. Adults want to do fun stuff. It doesn't matter what they're listening to. People that listen to fucking country music do drugs and sex too.
Yeah. Well, Ford and his wife thought otherwise. They had a long interest in what they termed old-fashioned dancing, and they hired someone to teach them this style of dance. And this was in 1923, and by then traditional country dance had already become out of fashion.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the heartland, even in the South, they had already started to be replaced with jazz and swing. He thought by bringing back square dancing and other primarily Anglo-Saxon, air quotes, dances like the waltz and shit, Ford believed that he would be able to counteract what he saw as the unwholesome influence of jazz on America. Jazz then, like rap now, is the cause of this country's moral decline.
Yeah.
So I found this article called 10 Things You Don't Know About the Origins of Country Music. Quote, Ford was frightened by what he saw as the urban decadence of couple jazz dancing. In response, he organized fiddling contests and promoted square dances across the country to encourage what he saw as an older, more wholesome form of entertainment.
No comment.
Yeah. In order to bring his vision to life, he spent all of his money. Like, he spent so much money. He's the reason why country music is popular today and why it's, like, lily white and so racist. He pumped so much money into that industry. He also published an instruction manual about how to square dance. It has, like, the stupidest title. It's so long. The title is, get this, Good Morning, semicolon. After a sleep of 25 years, old-fashioned dancing is being revived by Mr. and Mrs. Henry Ford. That title is 17 words too long.
Yeah.
Like, why are you doing this? He made his workers country line dance. He required his employees to attend square dancing events that he created for them specifically. He funded fiddling contests, and he promoted shows on the radio that highlighted old-time dance music. And he also created the modern square dancing club, where modern Western style square dancing as we know it was really created. That's all Ford. So everything we know of square dancing is Ford.
Yeah.
Sadly, like everything else, traditional square dancing was in fact built by black people.
I'm not surprised.
Yes. The call and response pattern that's like kind of a hallmark to square dancing resembled drum traditions of ancient African communities. The call and response form of calling out dance move initially started with enslaved people who were required to perform at white dance balls in order to reproduce steps themselves without formal dance training.
The cakewalk and all that.
Yeah. Because they were, you know, they were dancing. They had to dance or else, you know, you have to be entertaining. So I found a journal article. It's like super scholarly. It's called A Square Dancing Calling an African-American Connection. And they talked about how enslaved musicians then began to call out to white dancers, eliminating the need for a dance instructor. And he tracks the earliest known instance of a white person complaining about a black caller's voice, quote, their forced and vile voice And this was in 1819. So the practice then, spread from the south to the north, and so did square dancing. So Ford saw these dances as intrinsically white, obviously, and therefore wholesome. So black and Jew is bad. White is perfect.
Sure, yeah.
He campaigned to bring square dancing to phys ed classes across the country, believing that it would teach children, quote, social training, courtesy, good citizenship, along with, get this, rhythm.
If you want somebody to teach you about rhythm, look to an old white man.
Oh, right. But the schools agreed. And by 1928, almost half the schools in America were teaching square dance to their students. Square dance would kind of peter out for a while, but it didn't die completely as we know it's still around. In the 1930s, another square dance aficionado, a Colorado school superintendent named Lloyd Pappy Shaw, he might be on another scandal. So he helped revive the tradition once again and continued Ford's quest to spread square dance to more schools across the country. So he added to Ford's Good Morning instruction manual, and he created his own called the Lloyd Shaw Folk Dance Program. And traveling around the country, he got schools to implement it into their physical education programs. It was very successful. Over the next few decades, modern Western square dance clubs popped up all over the country. And in 1965, at the height of the civil rights movement, these clubs began their long quest to establish square dancing as the official folk dance of the U.S. So from 1973 to 2000, you look so tired.
I'm so sad about this. I don't know for sure if I was taught square dancing in school.
Oh, you weren't?
I might have been, but I don't remember it. But I remember I've always felt like square dancing is, there's something super like creepy about it.
Yeah. Every year we do it a few times a year.
Wow.
They brought out this like a record player and we would learn how to do-si-do and like Allemande and all these weird.
I mean, there's something fun about doing like a group activity. Like,
yeah. Country music as a whole is not the worst. From 1973 to 2015, there were over 50 plus bill proposals.
30 plus.
Yeah. Okay. Thankfully, all the bills failed at the national level, except for one brief time, and I will get to that later. So modern square dancers tried to establish the same thing on a state-by-state basis. The sponsors of the bills were members of organizations that promoted modern Western square dance, also known as club square dance, like what Ford created, basically. Mm-hmm. Club square dancing is distinguished from traditional square dancing in many ways. The clubs are structured into levels of dance. The mainstream level of club square dance requires dancers to be competent in 66 different square dance figures.
66?
Yes, requiring on average 60 hours of lessons.
Holy fucking
shit. So, a level of complexity that's unequaled in any traditional folk dance in any country. Club square dance also uses recorded music rather than live music, often choosing popular music over any form of music that might have originally associated with traditional square dancing. There are a myriad of industries associated with club square dancing, including businesses that sell a variety of products and services, recordings, costumes, certifications of callers, and dance paraphernalia. So yeah, they basically manufactured like a folk dance, requiring you to jump through all these hoops to be able to like do it right.
Yeah, like let's make it a capitalist venture.
It's the most dance. American thing ever. It's like they're creating culture in such an American way. Like I love it. So first I'm going to speak about what happened at the national level, and then I'll trickle down to the state level. The attempt to nationalize square dancing was granted in 1982, but only temporarily, thankfully. The resolution SJ Res 59 designated square dancing as a national folk dance in the U.S. was sponsored by West Virginia Senator Robert Byrd.
Okay. You said 1982?
1982.
So maybe they were drinking Blue Hawaiians as they were...
Possibly. It was Reagan.
Boot scooting.
Oh, God.
Sorry.
So it was passed by the House and Senate, and it was signed into law by Ronald Reagan. The bill praised square dancing because, quote, the American people value the display of etiquette among men and women, which is a major element of square dancing. And they went on to say that this is a traditional form of family recreation that dissolves arbitrary social distinctions.
Sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So who is this Robert Byrd fellow, and why would he push for something like this at a national level?
Do tell.
He's a complex figure, to say the least. Robert Carlyle Byrd was born Cornelius Calvin Sale, Jr., November 20th, 1917, in North Wilkesboro, North Carolina. When he was 10 months old, his mother died, and in accordance with her wishes, all the kids were dispersed to family members. He was raised by his aunt and uncle and renamed Robert Carlyle Byrd. And he was raised in the coal mining region of southern West Virginia. Working as a butcher in the early 1940s, young Robert formed a new chapter of the Ku Klux Klan.
Oh.
Yeah. In Sophia, West Virginia. So he writes this book. It's basically his biography. Byrd recalled his ability to quickly recruit 150 of his friends to the group's impressed Klan official, who told him, "You have a talent for leadership, Bob. This country needs men like you in the leadership of the nation." Byrd later recalled, "Suddenly flashed in my mind, someone important had recognized my abilities." Byrd led a growing chapter and was eventually voted the... These names are so silly. He was elected Exalted Cyclops.
What is this, Dungeons and Dragons?
Is this like Ulysses? Like, yeah. Why? I'm so confused. He claimed to have left the organization in 1943. But in a 1944 letter, okay, so there's a wiki page with all of American politicians who are affiliated with the KKK, and he's number one. But there's many.
What a great guy.
So he wrote to a fellow KKK member, "I shall never fight in the armed forces with a Negro by my side. Rather, I should die 1,000 times and see Old Glory trampled in the dirt, never to rise again, than to see this beloved land of ours to become degraded by race mongrels, a throwback to the blackest specimen in the wilds." This is after he left the KKK, so he says. He writes another letter. So this is in 1946. He writes to the Klan Grand Wizard at the time, quote, "The Klan is needed today as never before, and I am anxious to see its rebirth here in West Virginia and in every state in the nation." Just a year later, he becomes a member of the West Virginia House of Delegates from 1947 to 1950, and then the West Virginia Senate from 1950 to 1952. He was elected to the House of Representatives in 1952, where he served for 6 years before becoming elected to the Senate in 1958. So he's the longest, to this date, longest serving U.S. Senator in history. And 4 times he was the president pro tempore. Do you know what that is?
No. Okay.
If the vice president and the speaker dies, then you're president. So it's a little terrifying.
Yeah.
Despite Byrd's dubious claims of exiting the KKK in 1943, he will become a lot less racist as this story goes on. He hired one of the first black congressional aides on Capitol Hill in 1959. And he initiated the racial integration of the U.S. Capitol Police that same year, for the first time since Reconstruction. However, in 1964, Byrd led a filibuster against the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And not to be outdone, he voted against the Voting Rights Act of 1965, as well as most of the anti-poverty programs of Johnson's Great Society Initiative. In a debate against the anti-poverty legislation, Byrd said that, quote, quote, "We can take the people out of the slums, but we cannot take the slums out of the people."
Wow.
And it's like, bitch, you're from like a slum in West Virginia.
Yeah.
So over time, his politics do start to change. He's able to go from like a 5-star racist to like a 3.5-star racist. Okay. So that's massive for him.
Yeah.
Considering where he started. In the 1970s, he saw a complete reversal in his former stance against racial integration. He realized that he was on the wrong side of history, and it would be his biggest regret that he would talk about over and over again, that he was really sorry, he was misguided. In 1993, Byrd told CNN that he had regretted his filibuster in the vote against the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and he would take them back if he could. God, this is crazy. So in 2006, Byrd told C-SPAN that the death of his teenage grandson in 1982 is what radically changed his viewpoint. Quote, "The death of my grandson caused me to stop and think. The event made him realize, get this, that African Americans love their children as much as..."
Oh my God.
"He loved his own." Okay, yeah. He starts the KKK in his local town. He becomes this, like, exalted man of the KKK. Sure, he votes against the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, and he doesn't want to help poor black people, basically. Okay, I get it. You're an old white man from the South. But when I read that, I'm like, wow, you think black people don't love their kids? I never even knew that that was a possibility.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm glad that he's realizing that black people are are people.
Yeah.
Like, wow, okay. I'm glad you made it there. So he voted for MLK Holiday. This is when he starts to turn the corner. This is a 1983 bill. So this is a year after his grandson died. And he said that I'm the only one in the Senate who must vote for this bill because he's starting to feel guilty now. However, he kind of continued to be a little racist, but dramatically less so. So Byrd was the lone senator on both sides to both vote against the confirmations of Thurgood Marshall and Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court, the only two African Americans. He cited that he thought that Marshall was a communist, and that's why he didn't vote for him. And in the case of Clarence Thomas in 1991, he stated that he was offended by the injection of racism into the confirmation hearings because Thomas mentioned that opposition to him was a high-tech lynching of an uppity black man. And he thought that that was a diversionary tactic, he said. He thought that, quote, we were past that stage.
Oh.
And I'm like, you were just so powerfully white.
Yeah, I mean, like, he was offended. Get to decide that suddenly we're, like, even though you were, like, a few years ago, you were the most racist piece of shit.
But he did support Anita Hill in her accusations against Thomas, and he was joined by 45 other Democrats in voting against Thomas's confirmation. In a live Fox News interview in 2001, the 81-year-old Byrd noted that people, himself included, had learned a lot from his mistakes where race was concerned. He believes that we talk too much about race and that issues of race are largely behind us.
Easy for you to say, motherfucker. Yeah.
He says a lot of really nice things until he drops the N-word twice.
In the interview?
Yeah, I have audio.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Race relations.
They're much, much better than they've ever been in my lifetime. I just think we talk so much about it that we helped, I think, create somewhat of an illusion. I think we try to have goodwill. My old mom told me, Robert, you can't go to heaven if you hate anybody. We practice that. There are white niggers. I've seen a lot of white niggers in my time. I'm going to use that word.
Yep.
Oh, my.
Yes.
Oh, what year was this again?
This was 2001. So, of course, after this, there was an apology. I apologize, he says, for the characterizations I used on this program. That phrase dates back to my boyhood and has no place in today's society. As for my language, I had no intention of casting aspersions on anyone of another race. In my attempt to articulate strongly held feelings, I may have offended people. He may have.
You did.
Yeah.
Guess what?
So this is the man who pushed square dancing at the national level. So Ronald Reagan signs the bill on June 1st, 1982, but it's only good until 1983. So it's only like, it's 6 months that this bill is actually active. And the decision was made to limit the time because they thought it would be best to push on a state level to approve folk dancing as their official dance. And then at that point, they can push more strongly for it to be our national folk dance, is what they thought. Opposition came from various real folk music and real dancing communities.
Huh.
Folklorists and square dancing purists who thought the Western style dancing promoted by these clubs was tainted with new moves, their tendency to use recorded music rather than live fiddlers, and they didn't like that they were thumbing their noses at clubs that were open to the public.
The national folk dance would have to be this, like, very specific form of square dancing that was only possible if you had the means to be
basically
a member.
Yes. Yeah, that's, which is the opposite of square, like, of a folk dance. Like, everyone should be able to just, like, do a folk dance. If it's really the national folk dance, it shouldn't be
I mean, it's one thing to say if it's, like, the national folk dance is square dancing, period. Yeah. That's different.
So in the interest of time, I'm just going to look at one state initiative because there's 31 states and there's too much. In 1994, a bill sponsored by State Senator Leo Green was introduced to the Maryland Assembly that declared square dancing as their state folk dance. And there was one individual who testified against. He was pissed. I love this man. Stan Fowler. He managed the dance program at a state park, which catered to those wanting to learn how to square dance. He testified not as an official with the National Park Service, but just as a dancer in the folk community. He quote said, "It's cultural extortion. they're putting this cultural veneer on of mom and apple pie on something that's not even a real folk dance. They want to cram this down everyone's throats. It's like saying square dance, it's the law. I love this guy. So Stan is white, and he clearly called bullshit, because anyone who's a real folk dancer would call bullshit on this. It makes no sense. He says, quote, folk dance is people doing the dances of their area.
Mm-hmm.
Their region, their ethnic group, he says. The movement wants to homogenize dance into something like a bowling league with uniforms, steps, movements, rules that you have to adhere to. It's like making the Purdue chicken the national bird.
And I'm that's legit.
This guy has come with all the facts.
Yeah.
So after his testimony, the bill is defeated.
Wow.
People are just like,
what was his name again?
Stan Fowler.
Good for you, Stan. Yeah.
If you're going to have a state symbol, it should be different from every state. Like, it doesn't make any sense for 31 states to all have the same folk dance. This is a big country. Like, there's some...
It literally makes absolutely zero sense.
And he also said that the exclusionary nature of the club dancing is another reason why the bill, he felt, was really, really inappropriate. He quoted an article in Washington Post from February 6, 1987, in which square dancing at Glen Echo, which is where he works, someone said, it's totally open to the public, and they don't even meet our criteria for being a member of the Washington Area Square Dance Cooperative Association. So they're basically thumbing their nose at the National Park square dancing because it's open to the public. And it should be restrictive. Like, this is not how you do a folk
That's
dance.
That's not a folk dance.
This is not a folk dance. This is like an exclusive club for people who have the time and the money to buy all these costumes and take lessons and memorize 66 different...
And then when you get to that point, that's not a folk dance.
Thank you. That's what they're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not a folk dance. It's not at all a folk dance.
It's supposed to be, like, organic and, like, come out of something and evolve from something else.
Yeah.
And...
So a vote was taken immediately after the hearing, and it was defeated unanimously. However, club square dancers would not give up so easily. Within days, a letter was sent to the chairman of the committee asking the committee to reconsider its vote. And they included reference to the National Square Dance Convention. 25,000 people showed up to this National Square Dance Convention in Maryland in 1984. If they vote it down, they're never going to come back again.
If they like square dancing...
The National Convention is never going to come back to Maryland if they don't make it their state folk dance.
Oh, I see.
So they reversed the vote, basically. They made it the folk dance of Maryland.
Oh.
So... The convention was there in 1984, and then it came back in 2000. Just the value of a state can be bought like that.
Well, then, and then really it's all amazing. About money. Like, we need to have it this so that we can get this convention money.
Yeah. So, yeah, a month later, they signed the bill into law. Yeah, that's kind of that. Square dancing is still around. There's still push for legislation as recently as 2015. And it seems like they're not going to stop until all states have this as their folk dance, including Hawaii and Alaska and maybe even fucking Puerto Rico. Who fucking knows?
Yeah, like, why would Hawaii have folk, like, yeah.
I am that emoji with the hands out, like,
mm. Yeah.
Like, it's
ludicrous. It's ludicrous.
It's so crazy, but it's like, I had no clue this is where the story would go at all.
Yeah.
It's only a thing because of Henry Ford.
Yeah.
Yeah. He created club square dancing, and there became like the mafia, basically extorting people into making it their official state folk dance. Like,
that's craziness.
Yeah, it's peak white supremacy. So
good
so
times.
This is why I learned in gym. Thank you, thank you.
Yeah,
it's like I'd rather have like extra math classes. The end. You're welcome.
That was riveting. Thank you. That was really
fun. I feel like
fun.
It wasn't funny at all.
No,
but,
it was great.
Whatever.
Thank you.
That's why we have cocktails.
Yeah, America. Cheers.
Cheers.
All right.
This is when the fun starts.
Yes. So, picture it. Buffalo, 1901. President William McKinley was a year...
Oh my God!
Yes.
Woo!
was a year into his second term and traveled to the Pan American Exposition to meet his public in Buffalo, New York. The Pan American Exposition was sort of like the World's Fair. People from all over the world are going. On September 6th, 1901, he's at the Pan American Exposition. he's shaking hands in a reception line because he just loves meeting the public. He loves being like the populist president. So he's shaking hands in a reception line when he's approached by a 28-year-old named Leon Czolgosz with his right hand covered by a handkerchief. And McKinley McKinley assumed that the handkerchief was probably hiding a physical deformity because that was kind of common in 1901. And not wanting to be a dick, he doesn't stare, he doesn't react, he just reaches out with his other hand and extends his left hand to shake Czolgosz's left hand.
Yeah.
Two shots fire from a .32 caliber revolver under the handkerchief. McKinley is shot in his abdomen twice. He rises slightly on his toes before collapsing forward, saying, "Be careful how you tell my wife." And his aides wrestle Czolgosz to the ground. After several days in the hospital, at first it seems like McKinley's doing okay. It seems like he starts to recover.
Yeah.
But then he dies on September 14th, 8 days after he was shot, from a case of gangrene.
Medicine back then was not good.
They also never found the bullet. It was still inside of him.
Whoa.
And then there was gangrene, so there was probably, I don't know what the bullet was made out of, but it was probably starting to oxidize or rust or something. After his death, Congress gave the U.S. Secret Service the responsibility of protecting the president for the first time. So when the Secret Service was formed, their main duty as a government agency was in charge of suppressing counterfeit currency.
What?
Yeah. And they functioned as an intelligence agency. After McKinley's death is when they were like, okay, you're in charge of protecting the president's life.
It's like you need those curly ear things.
Yeah. They just wore like little curls in 1901.
They're like, one day this will be real. It will mean something.
We don't know why, but it will. So Leon Czolgosz is a Polish immigrant. He had worked as a child laborer in a steel mill in Detroit when he was really young.
I started to like research his story.
Okay. When Czolgosz was 20, he was working in a factory in Cleveland, and he lost his job in 1893 because of a huge economic panic that happened in 1893. And after that, he couldn't keep a steady job. He was spending a lot of time going to these religious meetings and political meetings, trying to sort of like wrap his head around the causes of this economic panic that cost him his job and sort of changed his life, because he had a steady job up until that point and then basically was just like destitute and doing these like weird odd jobs. So eventually he became an anarchist, and he blamed McKinley as the leader of what he considered a corrupt government.
I'm searching for the lie.
I know. So in his I don't know if you can say that McKinley directly caused this panic.
No. It's not one person.
Yeah.
But yeah, not at all.
He was just like the figurehead that he was going after. So in his confession, Czolgosz said, "When I shot him, I intended to kill him, and the reason for my intention in killing was because I did not believe in presidents over us. I was willing to sacrifice myself and the president for the benefit of the country."
I guess he's really on that anarchy tip.
Yeah.
It's like he's really doing it.
Yeah, he's just going for it. So it took less than 60 days for Czolgosz to go from arrest to trial to prison to execution.
What? No.
60 days.
No, less than
60 days.
No.
Yes.
Did we not have courts?
The court system was not what it is today, and it also... Less than 60 days to go from arrest to execution. And everything in between. When he was initially arrested, he was beaten badly by the men who caught him, and a mob formed wanting to lynch him on the spot at the World's Fair in Buffalo. They were like, "Let's fucking hang him up." But the police kind of stepped in and stopped everyone. And
did they lynch white people?
People who killed the president of the United States,
I mean, it's mob mentality. Mm-hmm. It just takes a few angry people to be like, "Yeah, let's get them." Mm-hmm. It's contagion.
But so for his protection, Erie County Police in Buffalo had to take extra precautions in transporting him from Buffalo to Auburn Prison in Auburn, New York.
Oh, what?
Yes, my hometown.
How dare you transfer this story from Ohio to your...
16 armed guards rode with him on the train, and another mob was waiting for him when he got to Auburn at the train station in front of the prison. Anyone who could reach him as he was getting off the train and being transferred into the prison did everything they could to like beat him and hit him on his way into the prison gates. Just a little bit of... background on Auburn Prison. So I'm from Auburn, New York. Auburn Prison is the oldest functioning maximum security prison in New York State. And when Auburn Prison was formed, it was built sort of on the outskirts of town, but it was one of the biggest industries in the town. So the town sort of ended up building out around it. Originally, it was not part of town, but now it's literally in the middle of town. My mother's house, where I grew up, where I was a teenager, is two blocks from Auburn Prison. My friend Sonia, who we mentioned earlier in the episode that where we went on this road trip, she worked at a pizza place across the street from a guard tower. When the prisoners would want their lunch, they would call over to the pizza place and have them walk across the street, and they would lower a bucket down from the guard tower. They would put their pizza or sandwiches or whatever into the bucket, and then the prison guards would raise the bucket back up into the tower.
Wow.
Because the town is sort of built up around it, Auburn is called Prison City.
By who?
Like, everyone calls it that.
Prison City, like, Auburn that's like a, residents call it that?
Yeah, that's like a badge of pride that, like, I'm from Prison City.
Oh.
So weird.
This is very...
Yeah.
Okay.
There's a band called Prison City Rockers. Yeah. And Auburn Correctional Facility was actually the first prison in the United States to ever use the electric chair.
No.
Ever. They did their first execution of a prisoner on August 6th, 1890. And there is a bar in downtown Auburn that has like a fake electric chair in the bar.
Okay.
Yeah.
My hometown is known for the Pro Football Hall of Fame.
So speaking of history of the electric chair, Thomas Edison helped finance the development of the electric chair because he wanted people to use electricity in all sorts of ways. Apparently there was another team of people that was also trying to develop electric chair, but they were using a different current. There was like AC versus DC.
Oh, yes.
And like there was this whole argument, and Thomas Edison wanted to be the first person to put an electric chair to proper use so that he could be like, we're using this current. And actually, when they developed it, the first time they used it, it was like a disaster. And the guy, they had to electrocute him for like 6 minutes.
Didn't they kill a bunch of animals with electricity? I feel like they killed like an elephant.
Yes. Yeah. I've seen that video. Yes. And Thomas Edison also loved to...
I'm like, you motherfuckers.
Yeah. He loved to record all these experiments. And so there's video of this elephant being electrocuted. You're right. Yeah, if you're a fucking sadistic fuck and you'd like to see this elephant...
Stop listening.
Yeah.
Bye!
Don't hurt us. So, Thomas Edison actually tried or wanted to record Czolgosz's execution because he thought that people would want to see it because everybody was in a fucking uproar. And
I mean, they probably would.
So there is video, there is footage on, like, the Library of Congress. You can find it all over the internet. But it actually is not Czolgosz's execution. What he did was he was there when Czolgosz was electrocuted with a camera crew. So he recorded all this sort of, like, B-roll of the outside of the prison and, like, within the prison walls. But then the warden said no. The warden wouldn't let him, or the state or whoever, would not let Edison into the room with the camera. Yeah. It's so inappropriate.
What are you doing,
so instead,
dude?
He fucking staged it. On a stage, they had an electric chair and they had a man like...
Okay.
Didn't kill someone.
Okay.
So there is a video of what looks like a man being executed, but it's not actually Czolgosz.
Damn! Wow.
Yeah. And a lot of the footage, when you look
fake
it up...
news.
Yeah. When you look it up all over the internet, it says that it is Czolgosz's execution. So it wasn't until I was, like, really researching it that I found out that it wasn't real.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. It's so fucking weird. This is a weird-ass country.
Yeah.
For such a young country, we've done some weird fucking shit.
A lot of weird shit.
So after Czolgosz's execution, his brother contacts the warden and asks to have his brother's
body.
To give him a proper burial. And the warden says no, that the crowds were there, the mob that was there.
No. They give it to the crowds?
No. What he says is that if we try and give you his body through the prison gates, the crowds will tear the body apart, you won't get it, nobody will get it, and everyone will get a little piece of it. Instead, Czolgosz was buried in an unmarked grave at the prison burial grounds about a mile and a half from the prison, very close to Fort Hill Cemetery, which is where Harriet Tubman and William H. Seward are buried.
Really?
Seward is the Secretary of State that I mentioned in episode one that helped purchase Alaska.
Alaska, yes.
Yeah.
It's like it ties to McKinley and Alaska. And, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he's buried in this sort of like prison burial grounds just on the outside of Fort Hill Prison. They were still worried that the crowds would find Czolgosz's body. People knew where the prison burial grounds were, and they knew that Czolgosz would be buried eventually, but they didn't know exactly when he was going to be buried. So the warden's like, okay, we're going to cover his body in quicklime to speed decomposition in an attempt to prevent grave robbers from taking souvenirs of McKinley's assassin. So they take this like kind of rough coffin that was constructed at the prison, take it to the burial ground, and they're going to cover it in quicklime, but then at the last minute, the warden's like, you know what, we should also use sulfuric acid. He was worried that the quicklime wouldn't do the job fast enough, and they were really concerned that there would be these, like, souvenir hunters. Sulfuric acid, quicklime, no big deal, why not? So an Auburn prison historian named John Miskell wrote that a small group of curious Auburnians assembled to watch the prison-made black-stained coffin being lowered into the ground. State officials, afraid that thieves would try to steal and display Czolgosz's body, poured 5 bushels of lime, 20 buckets of water, and sulfuric acid onto the casket to try and dissolve the remains, causing a cloud of smoke and steam to steep through the ground and rise 50 feet into the air after the grave was closed.
Yuck.
The only problem is that when you mix quicklime and sulfuric acid, the byproduct is plaster of Paris.
What is that?
It's not going to decompose a body. It's like plaster.
Preserves it.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, God.
It has to be mixed in a very specific proportion to become plaster of Paris. So some of it may have turned into plaster of Paris, but odds are it did help decompose the body, but it also probably didn't do exactly what the warden wanted. But the thinking is that Czolgosz's body was never found. This brings me to the next part of my story. Between 1873 and 1909, somewhere around 300 unclaimed bodies were buried in the same mass gravesite.
Okay.
In 1909, only a few years after Czolgosz's body was buried, the prison decided to sell the lot, and over the next 30 years, they claimed to have exhumed the 300 sets of prisoner remains and moved them to a mass gravesite at the Soul Cemetery in a quiet rural spot on the other side of Auburn. Records of the burial site dropped off the land deeds almost immediately after the state sold it, and records detailing the burials and exhumations were destroyed in a prison riot in 1929. Fast forward to the summer of 2016. Eric Johnson II, a 28-year-old contractor with a pregnant wife and his 2-year-old son, bought a tidy beige house on Fitch Ave in Auburn. He planned to put a detached garage and maybe a swing set in the backyard for his son. In July, he and his father were using a Bobcat excavator to level his yard and remove some shrubs when bones started turning up in the dirt. He said, "At first I thought it was a deer." That was until he found a piece of a human skull.
That'll settle it.
It was creepy. We kept finding pieces of bones. I was like, where are they all coming from? He called the police, and the medical examiner said the minimum number of individuals was determined to be 4. Those remains were transported and reburied at a cemetery at the State Correctional Facility in Marcy, New York, in Oneida County. No one was certain how many bodies remained in Johnson's yard, but they were sure it was more than the 4 that they initially found. A correction spokesman would only say that the state officials were continuing to work with Mr. Johnson and the city in an ongoing effort to identify, remove, and appropriately rebury any remains found in his property.
This poor guy.
Yeah, he buys a house. He doesn't know. This is a fucking prison burial ground that his house is built on.
Dude.
They supposedly moved all the bodies.
I'm sure he's not the only house in the area.
No.
Sitting on all the dead bodies.
Yeah. A reporter visits Johnson's home, and there's teeth and ribs and all these bones in the mud. And he and Johnson are standing outside, and they're talking. And Johnson's like, oh, yeah, there's a vertebrae. Like, no big deal. And there had been, like, tape around the scene, like crime scene tape. And he had just ripped it down, and he was like, I got tired of looking at it. I can't. This is my fucking backyard.
Yeah.
He said that he and his wife were sick of all the gawkers who would come and stare at the yard from the road or from the fence of the prison. Or not the prison, I should say. The cemetery. Their backyard sort of butted up to the fence. fence inside the cemetery. He had to build a like weird temporary fence around his yard to keep his dogs from digging and pulling out more bones.
So why didn't they come and get the bodies?
I don't know exactly what the holdup was. And like you already said, his yard was not the only house that's on this land. His yard is just a small fraction of the original burial plot, and there could be more bodies in the neighbors' yards yet undisturbed. The Johnsons were also not the first residents to find bones in their backyard. Joseph Crawford, a retired truck driver who lives next door to the Johnsons, found human bones while playing army and digging foxholes with his friends in the 1950s.
I like that he plays army with his friends.
Well, yes, I knew about the bones when we were little kids because we were back there playing army. And we would call ourselves digging foxholes when we ran up on the bones. And we called the proper authorities, and they came out and investigated. And basically, bottom line, told us kids not to dig back there no more. And then they explained that it was the bones of prisoners from Auburn Prison. And that was about it.
Wow.
Yeah. It's bones from prisoners. No big deal. Just don't dig there.
Just be cool, kids.
Another neighbor, also on Fitch Ave, Lewis Newman, said that he found bones also in the 1950s while playing. He said, "I dug one up once. It was just a skull. They put it in a local museum."
Oh, what museum?
I don't know. And Leo Shaw, who has lived on Fitch Ave since the 1930s, says, "Maybe that's why my vegetables taste funny."
Stop it. No, he didn't.
Yes.
Was that the end of the quote?
That's all I got.
Wow. Wow. I love him.
So a crew hired by the state returned a few months later and quickly began finding more bones in a relatively small area.
I'm shocked.
Johnson said he was first told that the excavators had found at least 10 more sets of remains, but from there the numbers kept climbing. By the time the state finished their excavation, the number they had found was around 150 bodies or more.
No.
150 bodies in this dude's backyard. There were no coffins, no clothing, no personal effects, just a mass grave. Thomas Maley, spokesman for the New York State Department of Corrections, said approximately 150 sets of remains were respectfully removed from their century-old graves on Fitch Avenue and, during a recent ecumenical ceremony, reburied in the cemetery at Marcy Correctional Facility in Marcy, New York. DOCCS will continue to work with the city in the event that any more remains are discovered. Since the public records showed that hundreds of bodies were already exhumed and reburied in the 1910s and 1930s, the number of bodies in the burial ground either appears to have exceeded the 300 that they originally said, or points to the possibility that the state said that they moved the bodies and never actually did it.
Yeah, they didn't move anything.
Eileen McHugh, Auburn's city historian, said, "It doesn't appear that they tried that hard." The original President Cemetery lot once stretched from Johnson's yard to what is now Fort Hill Cemetery access road on Fitch Ave, two or three houses down from Johnson's. Hobart Romig, a historical researcher who serves on the Fort Hill Cemetery Board of Directors, said that local legend states that Czolgosz was buried under that road. It's not likely true, but no one has found Czolgosz's remains, or at least not that they know of. But strangely, this is sort of where the story ends. Like, this is where it goes cold. They dug up his yard, they removed all the bodies that they could find, and that's it. There's no more information, and I've tried really hard to find verifiable information on what happened next or what happened to Johnson or the prison system or if there was any repercussions for, you know, in my mind, if that happened to me, I would sue the fucking pants off of the prison. So according to my sister, who still lives in Auburn, new, clean, like, fill dirt was brought in to fill in his yard and level his yard off. And a new fence was put up with some nice landscaping.
How about the homes that have all the other skulls and
There's
shit?
Not been any. They're not
I guess doing the skull anything. Is in the museum.
Yeah, they're not doing any exhumations. They're not doing anything to remove these bodies because that land has not been disturbed. She thinks that the state handled all the yard work, but I can't confirm that it was the state that did it.
Oh, I hope so.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming that they took care of it too, but like, there's no information that I can find. There's very few articles. There was something about it in the New York Times, but it was like when the bodies were first discovered. It looks like he still lives in the same house with his wife and kids, but I don't know if he ever sued. I don't know if he was offered a settlement. The most recent article I was able to find was from this small local paper, and it was basically like they found extra bodies, but that's the last piece of information. There's like a Facebook, like a forum for people that are from my hometown, so I went on there trying to find information. Yeah. And the only thing I could really find was like this thread that was like about how people were saying that he should sue. And then somebody was like, well, he wouldn't have been able to because if he had read all the paperwork and everything when he bought his house, it's probably in there that it was a burial ground at some point.
You don't miss that.
Yeah, and
you read
everything,
all the paperwork when you buy a house.
Yeah, so. And then everything that I read said that the last known record of this burial plot in public records was in the 30s. My sister, who lives there, speculates that he was either offered a settlement and was told to keep his fucking mouth shut, or there's like a gag order that he can't talk about it, and like the paper isn't supposed to do anything. They just want it to be covered up and people to forget about it. Like, there's nothing. I even reached out to the journalist who wrote the last article that I found in my local paper. I emailed them asking for more information, and I never heard back.
Hmm.
That's the end of it. I don't know.
Weird.
Yeah.
It's they like, totally did not move.
They
those
didn't
bodies.
Move shit. Especially if they they were that close to the surface that he just like was digging up some shrubs and found all these bones. But I don't understand how they built these homes in the first place and didn't find bones when they were putting in the foundations.
Yes.
They probably did and didn't do anything about it.
It's even darker.
Yeah. That's a fun story from my hometown. Prison City, home of a bunch of fucking dead bodies in somebody's backyard. In multiple people's backyards.
Oh yeah, they're probably everywhere. No.
It's like the poltergeist. Like, they moved the headstones but didn't, you know.
Yeah.
Not that there were any headstones for a prison burial ground, but you know what I mean.
Ugh, it's just so creepy to be living on a mass grave. There has to be so many bodies that they just haven't unearthed yet.
Yeah, and Czolgosz could be there. Czolgosz, he might have been in Johnson's yard, and he might still be there under somebody else's yard.
Here's the hoping.
So that's my story. That's
cool.
My tale. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thanks for listening.
Thanks for joining us.
Tune in next time. If you like what you hear, you know what to do.
You do. You know.
You know.
You know.
Our audience is really smart.
Until next time.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening. If you like us, follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Just search Beyond Reproach or Beyond Reproach Pod. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks.